Good morning, and welcome to a recap of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report podcast. I'm Sean Tubbs, the creator of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. In the early days of the COVID-19 emergency, I launched the podcast to cover the local and state response. Each episode tries to get the latest information about a crisis that is still developing with no clear end in sight. How well are we doing in terms of flattening the curve to allow our hospital system to prepare? We're going to find out. What you're about to hear is a review of the past week's show. We'll hear what's happening at the University of Virginia, Albemarle County, Charlottesville, and from other parts of the state. We'll begin with the University of Virginia.
Our sincere hope is that we will be able to be up and running and back to normal by the fall semester, but it's honestly too early to tell.
So far on this program, we have covered what Albemarle, Charlottesville, and Greene County have done, as well as what Virginia's government is doing. But those of us who live here in the Charlottesville area have to also know what's going on at the area's largest employer and institution. On Thursday, April 2nd, University of Virginia President Jim Ryan took to Zoom and YouTube to give a sense of what the university is doing.
All right. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining. We have gotten a lot better at Zoom over the last couple of weeks, but this is the first time we've tried a town hall with this many people, so I appreciate in advance your patience.
For those Governor Ralph Northam's Executive Order 55 is in effect through at least June 10th. Ryan said it's too early to tell what UVA will be doing in the fall.
Our sincere hope is that we will be able to be up and running and back to normal by the fall semester, but it's honestly too early to tell, and it's going to depend on the progression of the virus. We're now working to identify the date by which we need to make a decision by the fall. We'd like to push that date back as far as possible so we have as much information as we can to make the decision, but we also recognize that we need to make it far enough in advance so that people can plan.
In his town hall, Ryan announced that some residence halls would be converted for use by health systems workers and others in the community who may need to self-isolate as the pandemic continues. There will not be a final exercises ceremony this year, and graduating students will not walk the lawn, but Ryan said that something will be done to commemorate that time. A committee is considering the issue. Refunds are going out now for housing and dining services that will not be provided. It's becoming clearer how the closure of a school with over 20,000 students will have ripple effects in this community, with many people now out of work.
We are coordinating with the city of Charlottesville and Albemarle County on ways that the university can help members of the broader community during the pandemic and afterwards as things get back to normal. And we'll have more to share about that in the next week.
One of the biggest concerns about the response so far is the lack of test kits for COVID-19. Research at UVA led to the creation of a new method that has allowed capacity to slowly increase.
This was the first local test developed in Virginia, and it reduced the wait time from days to hours. We are now offering the test to hospitals across Virginia.
Ryan's comments were on April 2nd, and it's now April 5th. The number of cases continues to rise. What he said the other day, though, is still a valid statement.
This is going to get worse before it gets better. We haven't yet hit the peak here in Virginia or in Charlottesville, and models now suggest that peak will occur somewhere between late April and late May. So we are going to be dealing with this for some time, which will make it harder and harder. And we're going to see more patients in the health system with COVID-19.
In the meantime, UVA has moved classes online, and students can elect to be graded on a pass-fail basis. Here's Provost Liz McGill with an overview of more numbers.
If you want to be precise about it, we have 4,273 classes being offered this semester. They have all transitioned from in-person to virtual for this semester. This includes, of course, large lecture classes, but labs, discussion sections, photography classes, studio art, etc. 20,000 is the number of page views our teaching resource website had during the week of March 11th, which was all in preparation for the move to virtual instruction. 61,859 is the number of Zoom participants we had during our first day of online instruction, Thursday, March 19th. and 123 students have received support in the form of a computer or internet access, thanks to the work of our student financial services and student affairs folks who've provided that financial assistance for those who need it.
McGill said that moving learning to online comes with risks. Among them is a reliance on the Zoom platform. She said more lectures will be recorded and made viewable for students to watch as they can. The UVA Medical Center is under the supervision of Dr. Craig Kent. He's the Executive Vice President for Health Affairs and has only been on the job since February 1st. Here's what the status was on April 2nd. Remember, these numbers are already out of date by the time you hear this, but the general ideas are still valid.
Between our hospital and Martha Jefferson, which is our partner hospital, we have about 25 cases of coronavirus in the hospital at this point of time. If you look at the community numbers, it looks as if we've had somewhere in the range of 50 to 60 people in addition to those in the hospital that have been infected. If you compare those numbers to around the country, they're relatively low, even in comparison to Northern Virginia. Jim alluded to this in his early comments that when you look at the modeling, and you know, I'll just say that there's six different models out there, and every one of them says something different. So nobody really has a crystal ball. But I think over time, based upon experiences in other places, we're learning more about this disease. It's anticipated for the country that the peak will be the second week of April. I'm certain that our peak here in Charlottesville, Virginia, will be much later than that. The model that we have the most trust in suggests that it'll be about mid-May that it occurs. But again, you know, all of these predictions are tentative, and we continue to monitor this on a daily basis.
Kent said that gives the medical community more time to prepare and to gather more information about how to fight the virus and to be prepared.
There are really three essential parts of being prepared. One is to make sure you have enough beds. The second is to make sure that you have enough staff and faculty to support the patients that are in those beds. And then something that I know everyone's aware of, just because it's very popular in the press now, is PPE, or personal protection equipment. And what that is that the devices and material that we use to protect our providers so that they don't contract coronavirus while they're caring for patients. In terms of beds, we're really fortunate because we had just completed, we're close to completing a new 86-bed tower in our new facility. And although it wasn't ready to be completed till June, we asked our facilities people at the university and our teams in the hospitals to see if they could hasten that date. And I'm really proud to say that 15 of those beds are actually opening today. They're negative pressure beds. They're designed specifically for caring for coronavirus patients. And by May 1st, the rest of those beds will be available. So we actually believe that we're in reasonably good shape, considering the other 615 beds that we have available, that we'll be able to take care of a fairly large surge of patients if that were to come to pass.
Let's go back to the idea of dining services employees who don't have a job now that there is no one to serve food to. There were some articles this week about contract workers with Aramark have been treated after being laid off. Here's University of Virginia's Chief Operating Officer, J.J. Davis.
Given the change in UVA's operating status and reduced demand for services, for example, our contractors are not providing dining for now over 7,000 students daily through spring. Some contractors have needed to furlough their employees since there's no student dining fees to support the operations. Obviously, this is disappointing to all of us. We want to return to normal operations as soon as it is safe to do so, and we're hopeful that these reductions will be temporary. We are disappointed that the federal relief package did not send funding directly to employers, which would have allowed their workforce to remain on the payroll. However, I think there are some critical updates that are important to mention. We have asked our contractors to structure any reductions in workforce in ways that enable their employees to take full advantage of new federal and state relief. We hope that many of the contracted workers are eligible for a number of federal unemployment benefits. In some cases, this will increase typical unemployment insurance benefits and extend wages during this period of hardship. Also, many will be eligible for new one-time federal tax cuts between $1,200 and $2,400. As you know, this is very fluid, complex, and there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. But we are continuing to talk with our major contractors about what they are doing. Aramark is one specific contractor that has had great interest to many, including us. We want to mention a few things that they have told us they are doing for their employees. They have expanded their employees' benefit coverage by providing additional sick leave, health benefits, access to telehealth, and employee assistance program. Beginning next Monday, they're also implementing drive-through meal pickup program, offering 5 meals per week for Aramark employees and their families that have been furloughed.
The audio you are hearing is from April 2nd. Since then, the University of Virginia has announced they will donate $3 million to help furloughed contract workers.
We are in a challenging and uncharted times right now, but it is still all about the people. We are committed to trying to do everything we can, including working with our contractors to help meet critical needs of the people who make up our UVA workforce and community to sustain the university so that it remains an excellent place to learn and work. So I just like to say in the coming weeks and months, it's critical that we learn more about this virus and the impact of our ability to social distance now to bend this curve. I'm really deeply grateful for everyone in the UVA workforce and community for their dedication, their commitment, and hard work during these unprecedented times.
We're in a public health crisis and an economic crisis. For those of us in Charlottesville and Albemarle, we live in a place with a top medical facility with people whose knowledge can help all of us at this time. I'll do my best to bring you parts of those conversations as they happen. We need to be informed right now. For the next 4 minutes, let's listen to this series of questions from the April 2nd town hall. Important medical work is being done at this moment.
Okay. Craig, this is for you, I believe. It's a two-part question. Now that the FDA has approved a serotherapy protocol, will there be a push to find convalescent patients and begin therapy at UVA? That's part one. Part two, I guess this is both for you and for Liz. How will UVA help permit and support coronavirus research proposed by existing virologists here at the School of Medicine?
We have some very talented researchers here in the health system at the university that are doing some really wonderful work in the virology field, but also around coronavirus. And so we've encouraged them to double down on their efforts. That's more complex in our environment, where we're trying to create an environment where we can have social distancing, but working with those investigators in a way that we can support them to move their research forward, and it's so vital. Another answer to that question is that we have investigators that are not in the virology field who believe that they have tools and techniques that they might be able to modify to have an effect on coronavirus. And so we've encouraged those investigators likewise to venture into that area. We currently have three clinical trials that are underway. I don't believe one is the one that you just mentioned, but these are for in-hospital patients, not ones that are convalescent. But nevertheless, it you know, research in this area and providing the latest therapy is something that's really important to us. And we have a number of investigators that are carrying that forward.
Okay. You may have already answered this, Craig, but is UVA Hospital testing COVID-19 antibody treatment?
The answer is I don't know. We have so many investigators that are in the laboratories doing different work, and I saw that question, and I don't think I know the answer. It well could be the case. But the good thing about text and the ability to have Zoom is that Dean David Wilkes just texted me and told me that we have in the IRB a convalescent serum clinical trial, and it's on its way to us. So good that I can get online updates from my dean, and excited that we have that trial.
All right. Is there any way to send food delivery, gift cards, or other thanks and support to hospital staff?
So the answer to that is absolutely. And if we want to coordinate that, it probably should be through my office. So if there's a sense that that might be a possibility, please contact my office and we'll make that happen. I will shout out to the somewhere above 13,000 individuals that work as part of the health system, and every one of them is working day and night really, really hard to take care of our patients. And in any opportunity any of you have it to say thank you through a gift card or just a shout out, that's something that I think would really be appreciated. They're doing great work. I couldn't be prouder to be part of that team. And if that's an option to say thanks to our people, please let us know and we'll help facilitate that.
What you've just heard is a shortened version of a town hall that the University of Virginia held on April 2nd. I know you don't have a lot of time to listen to every single live stream, so I'm hoping the work that I'm doing can give you a sense of what's happening in local and state government. Please keep listening. We've heard a lot from Virginia Governor Ralph Northam on this program. You would hear even more if his administration was doing daily updates. They were doing so for the first couple of weeks of this crisis, but now they are giving briefings on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 2 o'clock. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear is giving daily briefings. Let's hear a little of what he had to say on April 4th.
All right. It is 5 o'clock, the time that we get together every single day. We talk about the coronavirus, we give our update, and we recommit to doing everything it's going to take to protect our fellow Kentuckians as we get through this. So let's start the way we always start, by knowing and saying we will get through this, we will get through this together. Say it with me. We will get through this, we will get through this together. One more time. We will get through this, we will get through this together. We will. We absolutely will. It's going to be a tough road. It's going to be difficult days. But we are going to make it. We are going to come out on the other side. We are going to rebuild. We are going to be a prosperous Kentucky where we can all get out and see each other, be with each other, celebrate birthdays, anniversaries. We will get there again. Remember that while other generations that were called to face challenges like we are called to face, most of the time when they face them, the time or even the victory was uncertain. We know here that we're not looking at years, we're looking at months. And we know that we will come out of this on the other side.
You're listening to a radio version of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report podcast, produced by me, Sean Tubbs. We'll be back for more after this short break. Welcome back to a radio version of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report. I'm Sean Tubbs. This morning, I saw one news report that stated with certainty that one model said the peak day of hospitalizations will hit Virginia on this one upcoming day. I'm not going to tell you which day it is, because we still don't know yet. There is not enough data, but more is coming in each and every day. So far, we know that the peak could happen sometime between late April and late May. On the April 2nd edition of Seville 360, Charlottesville Fire Chief Andrew Baxter said there are several epidemiological models.
All of those, I think, send a message to the community and to those of us in public safety and public health that are in a planning and response mode, that this is a long-term campaign. I don't think there are probably too many people walking around who don't understand that yet, but sort of working backwards from those dates, it's very helpful for us in being able to understand the type of logistical supports that we're going to need in the long term. And this is an ultra-marathon. We started out saying this is a marathon, not a sprint. It's really an ultra-marathon.
While we wait for the peak to hit our area, Baxter said that gives us time to prepare for when the surge will hit. We'll hear more throughout the episode of what's being done to get ready. At yesterday's press briefing, State Health Commissioner Norm Oliver said all of the Virginia Department of Health numbers represent snapshots in time.
Those numbers in and of themselves are almost definitely an underestimate of the actual spread of the disease in the community. We have been talking for some time now about the fact that we have widespread transmission of the disease. There are many people who have COVID-19 who are walking around in our community, and this is the reason why social distancing is so important. And we don't track those numbers either because we don't have widespread testing.
One thing I learned at the April 6th press briefing is that the number of hospitalizations reported each day comes from Virginia Health Information and comes from discharge information reported as claims.
That number lags behind the number that you would get if you were to ask that same question of the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association, which actually tracks the current census in the hospitals. And I would encourage you to talk with them about that. And that number will change, obviously, every day as the census goes up and down.
This broadcast is going out on the morning of April 12th. On the morning of April 10th, the Virginia Hospital and Healthcare Association reported there were 1,238 people in Virginia hospitals with either confirmed COVID-19 cases or the patient had symptoms, but the test was still pending. As of Friday morning, there were enough ventilators in use. There are many models that project when a surge of cases is expected. Oliver said the University of Virginia is working on a new model that will be released for the Commonwealth later this week. Until then, Governor Northam sounded a confident tone at the April 6th briefing.
Virginia is a leader in fighting this pandemic. Thankfully, this weekend, we did not see the crowds at our beaches and our state parks like we saw a week ago, and for that I say thank you. Science tells us that social distancing is the best way to fight COVID-19. That's why it is important to stay home. I know that it is difficult, but we will get through this together.
However, Northam said many people still don't realize that they can spread the virus if they are infected but have not yet developed symptoms.
That's one reason why the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, has now issued guidelines for people to wear cloth face coverings when they go out, such as to the grocery store. Face coverings can help reduce the spread of COVID-19. If a person is wearing a face covering, it is less likely that droplets from a sneeze or from talking will spread out into the air. And if you're wearing a face covering, it can offer some level of protection against those droplets. It also makes you more aware of accidentally touching your face. You don't need a medical-grade mask to do this. In fact, you can make your own. The internet has many patterns and instructions for how to do so, even if you can't sew. You can even use rubber bands and a bandana.
Northam even showed off a mask that was made by incarcerated persons still within the state prison system. If you are going out with a cloth mask, make sure you wash it at least once a day. And as I record this, Albemarle County has just sent out information that all of their employees still working in the field are to wear facial coverings. As we wait for the surge of hospitalizations, whenever the peak comes, Virginia continues preparations for 3 temporary hospitals and continues to find new sources of personal protective equipment, or PPE.
We have been working with every angle to buy more PPE. I'm thrilled that we have executed a $27 million contract with Northfield, a Virginia-based logistics company, to provide PPE. We expect the first shipment of PPE from Asia to arrive a week from today. We have also signed a contract with SD's Trucking to handle logistics and distribution. We have begun shipping 56,000 MREs, that stands for Meals Ready to Eat, to food banks. And this can supply our food banks for the next 6 weeks.
Yesterday, Northam announced that there are improvements at the state lab responsible for the official count of COVID-19 cases.
Our Division of Consolidated Laboratory Services is starting to use genetic technology to help our public health officials better understand COVID-19. DCLS is doing this work alongside the CDC and International Public Health and University partners. They are building a library of genetic information from the positive test DCLS gets, as well as those from private labs, health systems, and university systems in Virginia. One insight they have already learned, it appears that the virus was introduced in Virginia in multiple communities rather than spreading from one single source. I'm proud that DCLS is one of the first public health labs in the nation to do this very sophisticated work.
Virginia's participation in this program will help scientists better understand the virus and how it might mutate into new forms. But let's get back to testing. Northam acknowledged that Virginia does not have the capacity it needs to test as many people as it should be testing. Yet he said scientific advances are happening that will expand the range in the near future. Here's a response from Dan Carey, Virginia's Secretary of Health.
A number of patients are in hospitals that have testing results pending. Okay, two things. One is that's where the in-house hospital labs that are becoming increasingly available at UVA, at Sentara, the governor mentioned Sentara, here at VCU, and also the state lab, that is one of the priorities, that folks who are in the hospital and have a lab pending. Now, there are still thousands of labs sent each day to the commercial labs, because it's still important to know whether they have their positive or not, and those commercial labs are committed to getting those turnaround times quicker. It still is very helpful to know right away. So we've had folks in a hospital with a lab pending, but they send a sample to the state lab or to UVA, and they get it back in a day or a day and a half, and they're able to turn down the amount of personal protective equipment they're using on that patient. They have a viral syndrome. It's just not influenza, and it's not COVID-19. So what you're... It's important to have that testing because you get the results, but it's critically important for folks who are in the hospital to know if they have it, and especially if they don't have it, because they can decrease the contact precautions and all the PPE that the governor described last week.
One of the best parts of these periodic briefings is the question and answer session from reporters. On April 6th, reporter Daniela Cheslau of radio station WAMU asked a very pertinent question.
For all of the representatives and officials up on the dais, why are none of you wearing masks if this is the recommendation? Thank you.
We all have masks, and when we exit the building, that's when we wear our masks, but when we're inside in our offices, we don't keep them on. But I appreciate the question, and I appreciate you putting the message out there that all Virginians, when you're out and about, we would encourage you strongly to use a mask.
We began this show with a soundbite about models. One reporter asked about one model that showed that Virginia's peak would be on April 20th. Governor Northam urged caution.
I think we've made the point a couple times. There are various models. They change literally every day depending on the data that is put into them. And so we haven't made any adjustments by what we're seeing. We will certainly continue to follow the trends. And, you know, if and when we need to make adjustments in our guidelines, we will certainly do that. But for right now, as I just reinforced, that's coming from the national level and also from us, continue to do what you're doing. The stay at home is working. The social distancing, the frequent hand washing, all of these things are effective. So keep doing the great work.
Another question came from Henry Graff, who spent years as a reporter for NBC 29 in Charlottesville. Now he's with a station in Richmond. Here he asks an important question about some of the most vulnerable in our community. Locally, there have been confirmed patients at least two long-term care facilities in our area.
Maryland's governor issued an order requiring all nursing home staff to wear PPE and to segregate infected patients. Are you interested in something similar to that? And then can you kind of give us a bigger picture of how you guys are dealing with the outbreaks of the long-term care facilities?
Yes. I'm going to let Dr. Oliver talk about the nursing homes and the requirements in the nursing home. But I did want to comment. I'm not sure why they didn't call on you first, Henry, because in here you're the only one that I see has face covering equipment. So I'm proud of you. So, Dr. Oliver.
So the question, as I understand it, is are we taking any special kinds of precautions or procedures, interventions with respect to long-term care facilities? The Virginia Department of Health has 35 districts across the Commonwealth, about 129 local health departments, and those local divisions of the health department are working very closely with the long-term care facilities in their area. The idea is to, as soon as we find a case in one of these facilities, we've done very extensive contact investigation and then worked with the administration of that long-term care facility to isolate the case and begin to ensure that none of the contacts are actually infected and protect the rest of the facility from that. I think that what we've seen in Washington State and unfortunately here in the Richmond area and in Reichel, for example, is that if you don't get on that soon enough, you get a very wide, it's a population in which this infection can spread quite quickly. So I would say that what we're doing is we've stepped up our vigilance and surveillance in these facilities and worked more closely with them.
You're listening to a radio version of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report. That was Norm Oliver, Virginia's health commissioner, speaking on April 6th. Since that time, the state has formed a task force to make sure resources are going to long-term care facilities. You can hear more about that in the latest episode of the podcast. Google Charlottesville Quarantine Report, and you should be able to find it. Sign up in iTunes so you don't miss an episode. Now, let's get back to the review. These times require new forms of communication. The city of Charlottesville is getting word out to people through a new show called Seaville 360, which is being produced twice a week. One of the guests on the April 2nd edition was Chris Engel, the city's director of economic development. He illustrates how much things have changed so quickly.
It's difficult to comprehend how we arrived here in such a short time. We released the Office of Economic Development's annual report just 30 days ago, and the welcome letter to that report references an over 10-year plus expansion in this country in the economic environment. And obviously we've seen a shock to that. Here locally in Charlottesville, I referenced several figures which were records. We had the lowest unemployment rate in 15 years last month, and the highest number of jobs ever in the city of Charlottesville. We also saw average wage growth last year of 2.5% across all sectors and all levels of pay. We saw the highest level of commercial investment in the city ever. $145 million spread across a number of projects, several of which are large and significant, which we were seeing for the first time. Then, you know, in early March, things started to change, and by March the 12th, we had a state declaration of emergency, followed by a city declaration of emergency, and a virtual halt to trade and commerce throughout the city, throughout the state, throughout the country.
Seaville 360 is hosted by Brian Wheeler, the city's director of communications. Here he asks City Councilor Lloyd Snook about what his experience looks like from the perspective of a new elected official.
You know, Mr. Snook, you're a new member of City Council, and I'm wondering how you would characterize, you know, this experience you're going through as one of our local leaders and what you're seeing.
Well, it certainly was not what I was expecting during the campaign. We were, frankly, you know, sort of almost taken by surprise, I suppose, in March, because although we had been seeing news reports of things happening in Washington State and in China and so on, the reality that it would come to Charlottesville, the reality that it would come to stay-at-home orders here hadn't really sort of sunk in until about, I'd say, we had a budget work session on March 12th and another public hearing on March 16th. And over that weekend, we began, I think all of us as individuals, began to sort of get hit by the fact that we'd been planning for a budget that no longer made sense. That we'd been planning for a budget where clearly our revenues, our tax revenues, were going to be down a great deal. And we needed to do some thinking about that. There is a great hope in this country that we were immediately thrown into a recession simply by so many people. We now saw, I guess, 6 million more people being filing for unemployment this week. That's a huge number. And so the hope is that we can have what's called a V recession, where we go down sharply, then we come up sharply, as opposed to what we saw in 2008, where a recession that went down and then kind of gradually came back up. And it was 5 years before we could get back to where we wanted to be.
There's so much we don't know yet. What we do know is that local governments are going to have to adjust their existing year's budgets in order to cope with the financial effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Last week, I reported about Albemarle County's budgetary situation. The Board of Supervisors will need to revisit the current year's budget to cut $3 million in general government spending. Albemarle County will be moving forward this week with public hearings on the tax rate for next year. If you want to keep up with that information, visit the Piedmont Environmental Council's website at www.pecva.org and search for my name. There'll be an update on all the government meetings and happenings that are going on. I'm Sean Tubbs. We'll be back in a moment. Hello, and welcome back to the final segment in today's recap of the Charlottesville Quarantine Report. We pick up where we left off, with sound from an episode of Seaville 360. Charlottesville Communications Director Brian Wheeler is about to ask a question of Charlottesville Economic Development Director Chris Engel.
And the last thing I want to ask you to close on is any business adaptations that you've come across where somebody's done something innovative to pivot what they're working on.
Sure, there are a number, and it's interesting at times like these, create opportunities for people to be creative, and we are seeing that in the city. And I'll share just a few. You may have seen this was featured in the newspaper this week, but Osh Shoes is a local company that creates shoes using 3D printers, and they have pivoted to use their 3D printers to create a plastic mask. And they are partnering with their neighbor, Luna Innovations, to actually finish the mask and create the wiring that connects it to folks. Indoor Biotechnologies, another local biotech company, is creating proteins used in testing kits. And just another way to adapt their business in addition to what they're already doing. Cardboard Safari is a local company that makes products out of cardboard and balsa wood, and they are pivoting to make and cut plastic face shields in conjunction with another Virginia company that's going to finish the product. We've talked a bit about restaurants. Bodo's is a local restaurant, local bagel shop that's been around for 30-plus years, and they've reopened their drive-thrus magically, and they're seeing quite a bit of business.
That's Chris Engel, the city's economic development director, appearing on the Seaville 360 program on April 2nd. People getting sick now were possibly infected 2 weeks ago. We still don't know a lot about how this has spread. There are many epidemiological models out there that project potential futures. Governor Ralph Northam said they continue to look at all of them as data comes in.
We're continuing to work with UVA, University of Virginia, and they're continuing to collect data that is specific to Virginia. And I don't want to make any guarantees, but I think in the next day or so we'll have a lot more information on that particular model. They're getting very close to where they have the data to be able to make predictions.
It has now been 4 weeks since the state of emergency was declared. During that time, Governor Northam has held frequent press briefings to keep Virginians up to date on the preparation for a surge in hospitalizations. Reporters are able to provide you this information because public officials in Virginia are making it available. Northam thanked the press at the end of his briefing yesterday.
So I really do appreciate y'all's questions. I don't have answers for everything, but when we hear these questions, it makes us think of what more we need to do.
Over the course of the past 4 weeks, this podcast has sought to keep you as up-to-date as possible, and people come to me with questions. One friend of mine, who works for a local social services organization, is very concerned that their team is looking after clients who may be exposed to COVID-19. This person is terrified that they and their health are being put at risk for a non-essential service. At yesterday's briefing, one reporter asked what happens if employers withhold knowledge about infected personnel from other employees and customers. This answer comes from Northam's chief of staff, Clark Mercer, and it covers both situations.
And that is an issue nationally. We have DOLE, the Department of Labor and Industry, here in the Commonwealth, and that's the first place for folks to call or email or go online and make such a complaint. And then DOLE works with the federal government to address those. A call from our commissioner of the Department of Labor will get a business owner's attention. But I would say a few days ago we received word that a couple individuals had contracted coronavirus from a Virginia business, and we heard about that through the media. And I would say, one, thank you for the job that you're doing. It's important, and you're looking into important issues, and so we're grateful for that. The first thing that I did when I heard about that was get in touch with that business and cite our displeasure that we would hear from the media about these cases. It's incumbent on both the government and private sector to be transparent and to be proactive if we're going to get on top of this and we're going to be able to get out of this and quote-unquote get back to normal. So it's a two-way street. Obviously, there's a lot of folks who are working who are stressed, and if they feel that they're in a workplace where their employers are not being receptive to the social distancing, our Department of Labor and Industry is the first place that they should go.
Since the emergency was declared 4 weeks ago, the press briefings have featured information about how the numbers are collected. This podcast has documented these briefings. Yesterday, Northam further explained how the numbers are collected and what information is missing.
In a pandemic such as this, it is critical that everyone has as much information as possible, from the decision makers to the public. Data comes in from a variety of sources, both public and private. Our local health departments, the hospitals, the private testing labs, and more. It is difficult but important for everyone to be reporting the same types of data so we have a better picture of what this virus looks like here in Virginia.
As we look across the nation, it is becoming clear that the virus is hurting the black population in America in greater numbers than other demographics. We're going to spend the next few minutes on this topic because this is very important.
We are seeing racial disparities in COVID cases in places like New Orleans and New York, and we must be able to measure this here in Virginia. We know that long-standing racial inequities in things like access to health care, education, and economic opportunities lead to differences in underlying health conditions. The existence of such inequities is one reason why communities of color, including African American people, are more likely to have some of the underlying health conditions that put them at a greater risk with COVID-19. We need a clearer data about what this means in Virginia. That obligates us to do a better job of tracking racial demographic data of confirmed cases. I have directed VDH, or Virginia Department of Health, to make sure that we are doing just that. It is my understanding that private testing labs and some other private partners are not currently reporting this data. We're exploring ways to make sure that they do.
Norm Oliver, the state health commissioner, further outlined how incomplete the data sets are as of April 8, 2020. This is crucial to understanding how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting minority populations.
Virginia is one of less than 12 states in the United States to actually report race and ethnicity data on COVID-19. And with that, however, there are a number of challenges that we face. We do not have race and ethnicity data on 53% of the incident cases in the state. That's mainly because labs receiving data from providers who've taken test specimens from patients and sent that in without that racial and ethnic category information with them. And if the labs don't have that information, they can't report it to us. The VDH crews who do the case investigations and contact investigations collect all of that data, and the 47% that we have data for is the data that we've collected. We have the same problem with respect to deaths from COVID-19. About half of the deaths that we have no racial and ethnic data on that. That we can do much more to resolve, because as the death certificates are generated, we can go back and backfill that information in there.
We'll have more information on this as we get more data. As of April 6th, African Americans made up 28% of the total number of COVID-19 cases in Virginia, for which there is data.
Historically, since about 1970, the African American population in the Commonwealth has been around 20%. I will say that in addition to being one of the few states that actually collects this kind of information, we also, I think, are cutting edge in the way in which we're conducting our emergency management. The Unified Command that's leading our COVID-19 response has a health equity work group that is looking at every aspect of what we do in response to this with that lens of equity, diversity, and inclusion. So our logistics, our finances, our planning, every aspect of what we're doing, we're taking those things into account. And that's, I think, historic for Virginia and, for that matter, historic for the whole country.
The next question will be from Bruce Potter with Inside Nova.
Northern Virginia is likely to be a hotspot for COVID-19 cases. Northam said he is working with his counterparts in Maryland and Washington.
Mayor Bowser, the governor of Maryland, and I have been working very closely. We have tried to be consistent in our guidelines, especially the stay-at-home, social distancing, et cetera. We realize that the greater Washington area is at risk to be a hot spot.
There are around 426,000 people in Loudoun, and as we just heard from the governor's briefing, Northern Virginia is a hot spot. Remember, the Dulles Expo Center will be the site of one of the temporary hospitals that is going to be built in Virginia. Phyllis Randall is the chair of the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors and thus serves on a regional organization known as the Metropolitan Council of Governments, or COG.
In COG, we are asking as a region for to be a priority testing area. We have about 6 million people in the capital metro region. We are obviously the seat of federal government, and the feeling is if the federal government workforce goes down, then you know all the checks that are about to go out won't, you know, things slow down even more than they are already. And 6 million people is a lot of people, and in some of the areas they're fairly densely packed. So we asked to be a priority testing area. That was 2 weeks ago almost, and we have not heard back yet.
Randall's comments came during the Loudoun Supervisors meeting on April 7th. One of the questions to ask during this time is how much work can local government get done? Municipalities across the Commonwealth are operating under continuity of government ordinances, adopted after Attorney General Mark Herring issued an opinion on how local government should proceed. On March 21st, Governor Ralph Northam made this statement.
General Herring's opinion makes clear public bodies should ask themselves, is the action we're taking truly essential? If not, they should defer it until they meet in person again. We're not throwing out public accountability and transparency measures because there is an emergency. Bad policies can happen that way. The regular features of public meetings remain critical, including the need for public access, proper public notice, publicly available agendas, roll call votes, and recorded minutes.
This week, the Loudoun County Board of Supervisors met for the first time since adopting their continuity of government ordinance on March 25th. We're not entirely sure if their interpretation meets the standard that Governor Northam is setting up, but let's take a listen to get this on the record. Supervisors met electronically on April 7th, 2020.
So I'd like to call to order the April 7th, 2020 Loudoun County Board of Supervisors business meeting. This room has a hearing loop. If you need
That's Phyllis Randall, the chair of the 9-member Loudoun Board of Supervisors. She was in person at the Loudoun office building in Leesburg. The public was allowed to attend in present, and instructions were given to anyone with hearing difficulties to plug into the system. Chairwoman Randall and Supervisor Kristen Umstadt were in attendance at the meeting, as well as staff. As with many other localities, Loudoun is working to include public comment as part of their public hearings, learning to use technological platforms that were previously not being used. In a minute, we'll hear one such comment from one of my colleagues at the Piedmont Environmental Council, where I have worked for the past 2 years. Chairwoman Randall explained that much of the meeting would proceed as normal.
I will begin the meeting with a motion clarifying the electronic meeting. I will need a second on this motion, and then I'm going to go to Mr. Rogers to make any comments he'd like to make on clarifying legally how we're doing electronic meetings and what can be on the agenda and all those type of things, just because I want to make sure everyone is clear.
Mr. Rogers is Leo Rogers, the Loudoun County attorney. Here's his interpretation in full.
That continuity of government or the essential functions of government are nowhere defined in the code. But the Attorney General does explain in his opinion about continuity of government and those essential functions that the government might need to take during this disaster. Those are decisions that the board, in consultation with staff, needs to make as to what goes on the agenda and whether or not those actions are required during this emergency. The continuity of government ordinance is suspending the requirement that a physical quorum be here or that members of the board cannot be participating electronically, as that's necessitated due to this disaster. So the board should be using that with a circumspect eye as to what's on the agenda and what actions are taken. It is not limited strictly to the emergency. There's a provision in the code dealing with emergency meetings dealing just with the emergency. This is a continuity of government ordinance, and those essential functions of government might change as the disaster progresses. What may not have appeared to be essential in April, if this disaster is continuing in the fall, would be more essential.
Loudoun supervisors voted unanimously to proceed with an electronic meeting that included two land use applications for which public hearings had already been held. Next week, they will hold several public hearings for items that so far haven't had any public input. Jem Bengel, one of my colleagues at the Piedmont Environmental Council, raised some concerns.
On behalf of the Piedmont Environmental Council, I urge you to pause and reflect on the importance of the public in public process before moving forward with non-emergency items on the April 15 public hearing agenda. If your emergency ordinance regarding suspension of deadlines during the disaster and postponing non-emergency public hearings isn't adequate, please consider asking applicants to extend their deadlines in the short term. Consider Governor Northam's question, is the action you plan to take truly essential?
That was Jem Bingle of the Piedmont Environmental Council. I couldn't agree more with Jem. As Governor Northam said, we're in a public health care crisis first, and any local government decision should be delayed for now if they don't deal with the emergency. There are currently no scheduled city council meetings, but that could change. I'll be posting a newsletter on the PEC website about this on Monday. As part of that newsletter, you'll read all about how the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors is holding three public hearings on three items next Wednesday, April 15th. Greene County will hold two on Tuesday, April 14th. I'll be reviewing those applications as part of my duties working for the Piedmont Environmental Council. Now more than ever, we need transparency. In fact, let's hear that quote again from Clark Mercer, Governor Northam's chief of staff.
It's incumbent on both the government and private sector to be transparent and to be proactive if we're going to get on top of this and we're going to be able to get out of this and quote-unquote get back to normal.
And that's the end of this installment of the Charlottesville COVID-19 Report. If you're enjoying this program, please tell some friends. I'm trying to bring you information here that I think you need in order to get through this time. This is work that I'm doing on my own at my house under my own expense. I sort of leapt into this very suddenly. I do have a day job at the Piedmont Environmental Council, and they've been very supportive of these efforts. If you'd like to be heard on future episodes, please send me an email to wordcast@gmail.com in order to let me know something you might like to talk about. If you want to go ahead and just send me some sound, why not try recording something on your phone and mailing it to me at wordcast@gmail.com. This can be anything, up to 3 minutes long if you like. Tell me about your day. Tell me about some of your hardships. Tell me some things that you hope for. Tell me some things that you're really not so hopeful for. Please send me some information, and I would love to get it on. I'm Sean Tubbs, and thanks for listening to this installment of the Charlottesville COVID-19 Report.